Who am I?
Oh, my child, she said. I was afraid you were going to ask that. Hurry, go tell your father what you told me. So that star went to its father, the sun, and said, Father, who am I? And he immediately chastised him, said, my child, be very careful with that question, for that question is the most important question we have as a soul. But those stars, those souls are like us today, hard to keep a secret. And soon there were four of them that asked that question. And thus their souls came on the pathway of souls. Our stories say that we come from the Seven Sisters constellation of what you call Pleiades, and that we journey here guided by the morning star, which is Venus, our next planet. And then when our temporal bodies are done, then we go home to God that way. And when those four souls made the migration to this plane, this planet was all water. And they took the form of four animals. The first one who asked the question was turtle. Then there was a waterfowl. Then there was otter, and then there was a deer. And each of the Lord's creations looked at their form, and the turtle noticed that its paws were webbed and made for the water. This beautiful shell with 13 different pieces on it that said, I can be in the water, but maybe I'm made for something else. Next, that waterfowl exercised its wings and said, my feathers, they float on this water. My feet are made for this, but I can fly. Otter noticed the same with his paws and the beautiful fur that it had and his powerful tail. He too said, I'm made for this and for something else. But then there was the sister deer, and she was not made for the water, and she labored. And those souls, when they took the form of animals coming here, they remembered only the core teachings. We're all related. Water is life. Be good to one another. Help one another. And so they remembered those, and they began to help their sister, the deer. And at first, Turtle felt responsible, and so dove down deep into the waters as slow as it might be, and instructed the waterfowl to fly big circles, always coming back over the same spot to find something. And Otter stayed with deer. And eventually they see Turtle coming up, and then the waterfowl lands in the water. And they both shook their head. Our language, dingue, means I found nothing. So Otter said, let me try, Brother Turtle. And so Turtle got underneath the breast of the deer to push up, and the waterfowl grabbed hold of the nape of the neck on the deer, and they struggled to keep her afloat. Down Otter went. He's gone a long time. Just when they're about to give up hope, they see the form coming towards the surface. And when Otter got to the surface, opened his paws, and there was the clay that we were born out of. Turtle felt so bad about getting them into this scenario, put the clay onto its back, and out came the earth. And that's why we refer to this land as Turtle Island. If any of you have been to any of our ceremonies, you know that we always sing and we have a drum. That drum is symbolic of the heartbeat of the mother. And as long as we sing, then she's going to be all right. In our teachings, we view things not simply as land or water. We view it all as our mother. And we are taught to love this planet as we would love our own mother, and that we should defend her honor at every turn. In today's day, there are so many challenges to Mother Earth, and I know that my heart is with yours and that we are hurting her. The analogy has been made of, you know, we have stripped her of so many of the forests that how can she breathe with her lungs gone? We extract things from the soil. We put things into the waters that we shouldn't. And we violate the sanctity of life often. One thing I know for certain is that if we are to be participants and not in dominion, not even stewards of the land, and the water and the animal nation and the plant nation, that we all need to do it together. And so in defense of our mother, I know that we all stand in unity to do what we can. I wanted to say thank you to each and every one of you for being here at this wonderful conference. Pause, I want to thank you for the honor for inviting me to be here. And I will leave you with some of our teachings. There are the seven grandmothers: love, honesty, truth, bravery, wisdom, humility. And there are rules that go with those relationships. Water is life. We are all related. We should honor the knowledge of our communities, our elders. And the most important teaching, it was gifted to me by an Odawa elder out of Saskatchewan, Dr. Cecil King. And he told me of the law of orders that says that the plant nation should come first. The animal nation comes second, for the animals depend upon the plants. And it's into the animal nation which Wakanda, God, has conferred many magical powers. And if they choose to give some to us, the human beings, then we must know our place. We must be tertiary to the animals and the plants. For if we put ourselves in dominion over, we will but destroy ourselves. And many think that's the world that we're in here today. So again, welcome to our homelands. Omahas have only been here for probably about 700 years. The Pawnees have been here for at least 1,500. So again, I thank you, and I welcome you to our homelands. I hope.
Thank you, Taylor, for that welcome. Nice to see you. My name is Belina Bentledge, and I serve as the sustainability coordinator here at Creighton University, so I've had the pleasure of getting to know Taylor. So thank you again for that beautiful creation story and orientation. So I'm here to introduce our next plenary topic: what is happening to our common home, and our next speaker, Dr. Martha Schulsky, Nebraska State Climatologist and Director of the Nebraska State Climate Office. In Laudato Si, Pope Francis calls us to recognize how our common home has been and continues, quote, falling into serious disrepair, Laudato Si 61. Details of this disrepair include pollution, climate change, issues of water quality, quantity, and access, biodiversity loss, global inequality, and the brokenness of society at all levels. All of this abuse, neglect, and deferred maintenance have been addressed by what Pope Francis describes as weak responses, politically and internationally. We will hear from our speaker, Dr. Schulsky, about what is happening to our common home, not to, in the words of Pope Francis, to satisfy curiosity, but rather to become painfully aware, to dare to turn what is happening to the world into our own personal suffering, and thus discern what each of us can do about it. It is my pleasure to now introduce you to Dr. Martha D. Schulsky, Director of Nebraska State Climate Office, Nebraska State Climatologist, and Associate Professor of Applied Climate Science in the School of Natural Resources at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Her research interests are in the areas of climate variability and change and climate impacts, and she has contributed to dozens of peer-reviewed scholarly journal articles. Dr. Schulsky holds a PhD in soil science and climatology from the University of Minnesota. Dr. Schulsky is a parishioner at St. Michael's Catholic Parish in Lincoln. So welcome, Dr. Schulsky.
Thank you. I'm going to do something that I don't normally do, which is read from a script, but... Thank you very much for this incredible honor to be invited to the Catholic Climate Conference. Although I've lived in several different places across the country, I'm a Nebraskan by birth and by choice. My father actually graduated from Creighton University in 1956. Growing up on a farm in southeast Nebraska, he had a severe passion for weather, as most people in the plains do. I inherited his passion for weather and became a meteorologist. When I was in graduate school, I took courses in applied sciences and studied how the weather and climate impacts people, our health, ecosystems, how we grow our food. This was fascinating to me and became my professional goal, to serve as an applied climatologist, someone who studies the interaction of climate and our environment, our common home, and works with people to find solutions. Unfortunately, my dad passed 5 years ago before I became state climatologist of Nebraska, but I'd like to think that he is looking on us all and smiling at us gathered here. So you might be asking yourself, we have a state climate office? I did not know that. We exist to track Nebraska's ever-changing weather conditions. Should pay attention that I have slides up here. Through our state weather network, one of the weather observing stations is up here on the screen, and collect observations long enough so that we have a local climate record. From this record, we know that temperatures have risen, its springs are increasingly wetter. We exist to help people decipher complicated climate model projections, answering the question, how will climate change impact me? It's not a very easy question to answer, and what can I do about it? We serve farmers and ranchers, natural resource managers, public power utilities, cities, Rotarians, business leaders, the media, state agencies, insurance firms, law offices, youth, retirees, researchers, faith communities. When the phone rings, you don't know who is on the other line, okay? Our job is to compile, synthesize, and translate complex climate data so that it can be used for decision making in a meaningful way. We help people look at climate scenarios and manage their risk to our state's variable and changing climate. I'm currently working with three Nebraska towns to do just that, in fact. So I've used both the terms weather and climate thus far, and I wanted to make a point to clarify that these words have two different meanings. Sometimes they're used interchangeably, and they probably shouldn't be. So I'm going to give you a little tip that you can tell people. Weather is your mood, and climate is your personality. Okay? If you like baseball, we just had the College World Series here. Weather is your at-bat, and climate is your batting average. So your mood can and usually does change from day to day, but your personality is a reflection of your overall demeanor and what your extremes are. So, since this is a Catholic conference, I have a confession to make. In preparing my remarks for this event, this was the first time I'd actually read all the way through the Pope's encyclical. I found it to be scientifically factual, a beautiful reflection, and a necessary tough call to action on where we must go and how we must change. Last year, I was able to attend the public lecture that Creighton hosted that was provided by Dr. Ramanathan, which was Pope Francis's science advisor, one of them. I found it to be insightful and inspiring. One of the attributes I was struck by was his ability to tell a story, to make climate change human, and to connect. Taking action from local to global, personal choices to policy implementation on climate change requires and will require human behavior change. In my opinion, we must connect with people so that they care about this crisis. Tell them a story, localize it, and provide tangible solutions so that meaningful action can be done. Our changing climate is now termed an existential threat. It is one of the most challenging issues of our time. At this point, we need action soon to mitigate severe impacts of future climate change. The longer we wait, the more risky it is. So think about this scenario, and this is a tough one, I'll warn you. Several medical doctors have told you that one of your children has been diagnosed with a serious life-changing illness, that she needs treatment urgently to preserve her quality of life. What if you told those doctors that you don't believe them, and that you're going to wait and see how things play out and hope that she will adapt. That would in no way be a risk that I am willing to take, and I have two kids. I'm also a mother. I would take the advice of the trained scientists and do what I could to preserve life. Some takeaway points that you can hopefully remember from this talk are: it is real. It is here and all around us. Human activities are responsible. It is bad for our common home. Those the least able to cope, the poor, elderly, sick, children, marginalized, will be the most impacted. The scientific community is in agreement of these facts. Facts. But the good news, there is hope. We are the solution. So before I delve into climate change, I'm going to talk about a few key facts of our climate that's important to take note of. One is that our common home climate is a system. It's composed of our diverse landscape, the vast ocean that is key for heat storage and transport, our fast-moving and dynamic atmosphere, and our natural air conditioner, the frozen world of ice and snow. There are complex interactions that take place among and between these four components of our climate system. Scientists have become remarkably good at using math and physics and chemistry to model our natural world, and these models are consistently improving over time. The fifth component of our climate system is us, it's people. We alter the landscape and have put quite a fingerprint on our common home. In fact, scientists are now discussing the dawning of a new era to describe human influence on Earth, termed the Anthropocene. The second point worth noting is that climate varies and changes because of natural causes. At very long time scales, tens to hundreds of thousands of years, the energy we receive from the sun is altered enough to change our climate. This happens through changes in the Earth's orbit and is termed Milankovitch cycles, if you've ever heard of that. If you haven't heard of that term, you've probably heard of ice ages. These cycles determine the cold glacial and warm interglacial periods. On a much shorter time scale, there's variability in the energy output of our sun, which impacts the temperature on our common home. Volcanic activity influences our climate. As particles are ejected into the atmosphere, it can reduce solar energy and cool the global average temperature temporarily. And finally, the climate varies naturally through what are called teleconnection patterns. Variability in circulation of the ocean and atmosphere for portions of the globe that have global implications. You've probably heard of at least one of these, which is El Nino, which means the Christ child. So I'll go through some of the points now. Climate change is real and it is here. We know from many types of data sources that monitor weather and climate conditions of Earth, some of which you see here. We're looking at the global average temperature as well as the Nebraska average annual temperature. We know that the temperature of our common home has warmed. It now has a fever, which if left unchecked will approach dangerous levels with dire consequences. We have been taking the temperature of Earth in a systematic way for over a century, some places even longer than this. We see that variability on an interannual and decadal scale due to natural factors, which this graphic illustrates here. But don't be fooled by the ups and downs. It's the long-term trend that describes climate change. Here in Nebraska, we live in a highly continental climate where the variability from year to year is very strong. We see that temperatures in Nebraska have warmed at a rate similar with the global average temperatures. We know that the rate of warming has increased in recent decades. We know that nights have warmed twice as much as days have. When and how we receive precipitation has also shifted as our years are becoming slightly wetter over time. We also see that climate does not change uniformly around the globe. Certain areas have warmed more than others, and this is to be expected because of regional differences. Let's take the Arctic, for example. It's warming at least twice as fast as the rest of the world. Why, you might ask? Changes are amplified here because these areas are losing ice and snow that absorbs, they're absorbing rather than reflecting more energy, warming up much quicker than any other area on our common home. There's a saying I've heard from those in the Arctic, which is climate changed. We can look beyond the weather records at other observations of our common home, and it also tells the story. Sea level is on the rise, putting communities around the globe at serious risk. Half of the world's population, half, lives within striking distance of a coastline, and climate projections paint a serious picture for how much land will be underwater. The two main causes of sea level rise is land ice melt, as well as thermal expansion of the ocean. Here in the US, some areas even experience what is called nuisance flooding as the sea makes its way into coastal cities even on a sunny day. Aquatic and terrestrial species are shifting. Pests and disease are moving into new areas. What we plant and grow is now different than decades ago. Snow at higher elevations is less. Glaciers are melting and permafrost is thawing. These changes describe what has happened in the modern era, but in a proximal way, we can observe our climate history through the camera lens of ice cores, lake sediments, tree rings, and other methods. In doing so, what it tells us is that we are warmer now than what we have been for hundreds of thousands of years. What's even more striking is that our climate is now changing faster than at any point in modern civilization. This current rate of change and an acceleration of this rate is very concerning. Climate change is real, it's here, and it's us. We've known since the 1800s that carbon dioxide and other gases absorb energy that's emitted by Earth and re-emit it back to us, keeps us warm and habitable in what's called the greenhouse effect. In fact, we would be about 60 degrees Fahrenheit colder at the global average temperature were it not for this effect. But what we don't want, however, is an enhancement of the naturally occurring greenhouse effect. We know that carbon dioxide is currently at a level we have not experienced in human history, greater than 400 parts per million. It's staying that way year round. This is a well-mixed gas in the atmosphere and lasts for a century or more. By analyzing air bubbles trapped in the ancient ice at our polar regions, we know that the current concentration of carbon dioxide is at unprecedented levels. Left unchecked, the naturally occurring carbon cycle is not able to keep up with all the extra carbon we are putting into the atmosphere. At this stage, it is pollution. The main sources, in the US anyway, that emit greenhouse gases is from industry, energy, and transportation. I mentioned earlier that we can mathematically model our climate system. When we start these models at 1900 and have them run through time to recreate our climate, they can only do so accurately when we take into account both natural and anthropogenic forcings. Only when we factor in the human component, land use change and greenhouse gas concentrations primarily, do we correctly simulate what is happening to our common home. Climate change, it is bad. Years ago, when my sons were 3 and 5, I recall seeing an image on the news that still haunts me today. The image was of a small boy, also 3 years old. His lifeless body had washed up on a beach that was thousands of miles away from where I was sitting comfortably in my Nebraska home. This boy was a refugee fleeing to safety from the Syrian crisis with his family. He didn't make it, and many others have not made it. Millions of people have fled from Syria in recent years. Political upheaval was fueled in part by drought and consequent food shortages in the years leading up to the start of the conflict. Climate-induced stressors played a role here. It led to mass migration of populations. This is expected to worsen in the coming decades as people flee to find a suitable place on our common home. So I used to live and work in the subarctic of Fairbanks, Alaska. This is not Fairbanks, by the way, where I studied our changing climate. In the high north, many aspects of life are very different than what they are here in the mid-latitudes. Cost of living is exceedingly high. The climate is very harsh. There's limited access to food, access to services, access to pretty much anywhere. The landscape is changing dramatically here. Ecosystems and communities depend on a frozen environment, and increasingly, this frozen environment is going away. Because sea ice is melting and shrinking, coastal villages are at serious risk to erosion. This one is Shishmaref, by the way. Without the natural buffer of ice to protect infrastructure, they are exposed to wave action and flooding that are threatening communities. These villages are largely indigenous, Native Alaskan, and have experienced forced assimilation within recent memory. These areas have limited access. There are no roads that lead in and out, and you must fly. So how do you relocate a community? Where do you go? How will it be paid for? These are real questions that are not easy to answer, but they must be. They're people's livelihoods. This is not an isolated case of one village, but for hundreds of communities all throughout the High North. Changes are happening fast all across the Arctic, and predictions are for this to continue at an accelerated rate. Communities are at high risk for serious impact. But we don't have to go to Asia or to the Arctic. Right here in Nebraska, we recently experienced one of the worst floods in our history. Show of hands, by the way, how many of you live in Nebraska? You all experienced this firsthand, I did. Four lives were lost, livestock were left stranded or even crushed by ice, communities were cut off when levees failed, damages are estimated at $2 billion currently. Floods are complex natural disasters and are a function not only of weather variables, but how we manage water and our built environment. The floods during March of 2019 was not only the result of a massive storm, which if you're not from here, you may have heard that on the media, the quote bomb cyclone, that impacted much of the country, brought blizzard conditions to the west, heavy rain in the east. This is one factor, but just as important, if not more, was the antecedent conditions that were in place leading up to it. It set the stage as the storm marched across the plains. The fall and winter was wet, and the ground was at or near saturation. February was quite cold with Arctic air. It was fifth coldest, I believe, on record for Nebraska in February. Arctic air infiltrated and deepening frost depths. Snow was plentiful, and several inches of water was sitting atop a saturated and frozen ground. When we think about climate change projections, they tell us that we can expect winters and springs to be wetter. So think about these antecedent conditions that I talked about. We can expect more heavy rain events in the warmer world. We can expect more variability. Even a cold air outbreak, which may be counterintuitive, that is a function of climate change as the jet stream gets more wavy and allows polar air to dive southward. It is us. For a number of reasons, climate change has become a political issue. It's not the case. First, I'm a trained scientist. I'm not a political scientist. We spend our careers studying how much the climate is changing. How does it vary regionally? What is causing the change? How can we improve our models that give us the projections? We understand that climate change is due to natural causes, such as volcanic eruptions that I talked about earlier, as well as anthropogenic or human causes. We know that on the local scale, there's something called an urban heat island effect. We build cities, change the landscape, and this influences the temperature and the moisture. We irrigate our crops, bringing water up from the ground to the surface for use by plants. There's added moisture in the atmosphere, and that can influence our climate. Decades ago, we used chlorofluorocarbons in refrigeration and later realized that reactions in the upper atmosphere resulted in a loss of ozone in the upper atmosphere, the protective layer that blocks harmful UV rays. Regulations were put into place to limit the use of these compounds, and this has had a measurable difference in ozone recovery. We know that humans influence the climate. The first known scientific publication on the influence of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere was published in 1896. By a Swedish scientist in the philosophical magazine and journal of science titled The Influence of Carbonic Acid in the Air Upon the Temperature of the Ground. There have been numerous studies on this topic and the influence of CO2 as well as other greenhouse gases such as methane and nitrous oxide. And by the way, water vapor is actually a very potent greenhouse gas. It just doesn't last in the atmosphere nearly as long. These gases have properties such that they are essentially invisible to incoming sunlight, but trap the energy that the Earth emits. Another key point, scientists agree. 99 out of 100 scientists are in agreement that human activities are the cause of the current climate change that we are experiencing. This is very significant for the scientific community. We are inherently doubtful creatures. We are taught to question everything, question our results, question others' results. We have anonymous peer reviews of our scientific results to give criticisms and feedback for improvement. If you doubt this, I would invite you to come to a faculty meeting and witness 20 faculty to get them to agree on anything. It's nearly impossible. This message, however, does not necessarily get portrayed in some of the messages that we hear. It appears that it's a 50-50 split, perhaps, that one half of the scientists argue for it and one half of the scientists argue against it. But that's just not the case. Scientists agree. The science is settled. On to more hopeful things. What's one of the best ways to combat this crisis? Talk about it. In real estate, they say location, location, location. In solutions for climate change mitigation, in my opinion, it's communication, communication, communication. One of the best things we can do to help our common home is to have dialogue. Start the conversation. Connect with people on our common values. Frame the issue in a way so that it is not controversial. It's science after all, it's not a belief system. Climate change does or will touch every aspect of our life, our faith, our health, our natural world, our economy. Find out what your audience cares about and start there. In a recent study that we conducted in the office that I work in, working with cities across this part of the country, we surveyed them to ask, what is the best way to frame the issue of climate change? By far, the top two responses were extreme weather events and economics. Another thing we learned from this work, make it local and make it relevant, and talk about tangible solutions. It's critically important to think about who you're talking with. The number one rule in public speaking, anybody tell me? Know your audience. I lost my place. The message and content doesn't have to be different, but perhaps how it's presented and how it's framed does. I'm a mother, and I care deeply about the health of my children and what the world will be like when they are middle-aged like me, when summer temperatures in Omaha will be like that of present-day Austin, Texas. I'm involved in the faith community. I care that tribal populations, the poor, marginalized, sick, elderly, will be disproportionately impacted by the impacts of climate change. I'm an empathetic educator. I teach a class on climate change each year at the university. And I feel the intense concern among students about problems they will face as our climate shifts to a warmer and more extreme one. What's another good way to combat this crisis? Plan for it. So a few months ago, I was giving a lecture about extreme events and preparedness in my class. And I asked my students, when is the best time to plan for a tornado? When the sirens are going off? And one is heading your way? They all gave a resounding no, this does not make sense. It's best to have thought about it in advance, determine a secure location, have a severe weather kit with flashlights, batteries, water, food, medicine, infant needs. Personally, we plan for change. We have retirement accounts. We go to the doctor. We care about our health. We save for our children's education. When is the best time to plan for climate change? That time is now. It will behoove the health and well-being of our common home, our livelihoods, and our economy if we have a thorough assessment of climate change impacts and a path forward for lessening our contribution to future climate change. There is a solution, there is a path forward, and that is through planning for change, making sure we have our disaster kit in place, making sure we're not only prepared for that event, but lessening the chance of that event ever happening in the first place. The sooner we act, the less risky it is and costly the impacts. Again, we're the problem, but we're also the solution. And finally, there's hope. We're a highly innovative people. We traveled from the Earth to the Moon after about 15 years of a concerted effort in this country. We've developed vaccines that keep populations healthy. Our technology has improved exponentially, even just the last few decades. We are finding ways to adapt, particularly in Nebraska, where farmers I talk with are already adapting. They plant earlier because springs are warming, choosing different seed hybrids based on the changing climate. We realize the importance of practices such as cover crops to conserve moisture, limit erosion, improve soil health. There's a climate change implications for Nebraska report published in 2014. I have a copy here. It's also available, all of it online, that the University of Nebraska supported this effort. Following on this, in 2015, there were roundtable discussions to bring together individuals and agencies, again, have a dialogue from various sectors about how to deal with changes predicted to occur in Nebraska. It is these dialogues that will help us achieve meaningful action on climate change. For action to occur, the dialogue must continue. University courses that really hit home with me when I was in school are the ones that brought climate together with people and the environment. In my introductory climate change course that I teach, I talk to my students, as you saw here, about how the Earth climate is a system, the atmosphere, the ocean, the landscape, and snow and ice. The factor in the system that I think is the most difficult to understand, model, and predict is people. By far, the biggest uncertainty in our global climate model predictions is human behavior. You might not have thought of that. We know that the Earth is going to warm over the coming decades. How much? That depends on what we choose to do or not do. We are inextricably linked to the climate system. It's something that affects us all. Climate change is a reality that we all face. We're all in this together. The reason I am hopeful is because of people like you, because of events like this. From what I heard from the father who's the president of Creighton, of all the great initiatives that are taking place on this campus. Because of cities that are signing on to a pledge that limits greenhouse gas emissions. Because of a brave Swedish school year, seen here, who's taking a stand. Because of a first-generation college freshman that I had in my class this year, student, who went to testify before the Nebraska legislature, which I would have been scared out of my wits to do as a college freshman. Because of all these activities, I'm confident that there is hope. I will end there and take any questions that you might have.